people, and welcome to a special edition of Lug Radio. You've got only half the valley today. You've got myself, Jono Bacon, and Mr.
Matthew Ravel here. Hello.
That's right. Let us introduce you to the premise of what we're doing. Basically, obviously, there's a number of issues that we're all concerned about regarding politics and open source and free software. Things such as the European Copyright Directive and software patenting and government use of software, all that kind of stuff. And Matt's been in touch with a number of different political parties to try and get their word on things.
Yep, I've contacted the Conservatives, the Labour Party, the Liberal Democrats, the Green Party, Sinn Féin, Plaid Cymru in Wales, and the Scottish National Party. I've had great difficulty getting responses from some people, but others it's been all right.
So be it. Yeah, well, we've got two interviews to share with our good listeners, haven't we?
Yeah, and we've got a response from the Green Party as well, which we'll discuss later. Right. We made an effort, well, we decided not to go for the, maybe say the single issue parties, such as the UK Independence Party, although they voted in quite an open source friendly way on certain issues in the European Parliament. Also, one of our listeners, Russ, spoke to the English Democrat Party. Because he emailed various parties himself to find out where they stood on things like software patents.
Thanks, Russ.
Yeah, cheers, Russ. Not that I think he did it for us, but it was good that he shared it with us.
Yeah, he did do it for us, honestly.
Oh, right, okay.
Cheers, Russ.
And basically, he got a reply from the English Democrats, and the lady that you spoke to hit reply instead of forward and said, I think he's a crackpot. So basically, our advice is don't vote for the English Democrats, apart from the fact that they're of a... questionable morals in certain areas. England for the English, all that sort of thing.
I think it should be England for the Linux users. Yeah, why don't we set up some kind of Linux-based party that we want all people who don't use Linux to leave the country?
Yeah, well, actually, have you heard of Sealand? There's that...
No.
Basically, there's this World War II gun installation just off the coast of Essex, yeah?
Right.
Which is just in the North Sea, just outside of the old international... British claim on water, yeah. So it's just
right.
In the international sea, and basically this bloke and his wife rode over there in the 1960s and claimed it as an independent nation and called it Sealand.
What?
It's Prince Roy and Princess Barbara or something like that.
So
maybe we should try and chuck them off and establish the Kingdom of Linux or something like that. But anyway, that's off topic.
I can imagine it now. No, it'll be King Matt, King Jono, King Ack, and King Sparks.
Yeah.
Right.
So back to politics.
The whole point of this. Should we kick off with our first interview?
Yeah. Basically, we got a really good response from the Liberal Democrats and Labour. We got quite a good response from the Green Party. Couldn't get much of a response from anyone else, which was...
It's the only reason why we got a response from the Green Party, because no one votes to them and they just wanted to speak to someone.
No, they are actually quite in favour of the sort of things that we support. So, but interestingly enough, the Liberal Democrats IT spokesman, Richard Allen, MP, is, I believe, a former open source developer and is very much one of us. So, yeah, have a listen to what I recorded with him. Richard Allen, you're the MP for Sheffield Hallam, and you're also the Liberal Democrats ID spokesman. Can you give me a general idea of where the Liberal Democrats stand on open source?
Open source generally, we're very strongly supportive of its development. We believe that it can make a huge contribution to the development of ICT in general. It already has done so, and will continue to do so. And in terms of the political role, if you like, then what we should be doing is creating a regulatory and political climate within which open source can flourish rather than one that aims to shut it down. And so that does mean tackling all of these questions like software patents, copyright law, and so on, and trying to ensure that we have a regime that rewards people who do work, but without allowing them to gain the ability to shut down open source projects that can make as big or if not a bigger contribution than their products.
Can you give me some practical examples of how the Lib Dems would help foster open source development, perhaps in government projects?
So, within that, we've been very supportive of the government's open source policy, which they published, I think, was it back in 2002 now? where the government made a policy statement saying that open source should be considered alongside other options, that pilots should go forward to demonstrate cost-benefit analysis for open source projects and so on. I personally have been very supportive of that in Parliament, have encouraged the Office of the Envoy, who are the owners of that document, to implement it, have asked questions on a regular basis of the relevant ministers to make sure that they do make progress with it. So we are very involved at a public policy level in terms of trying to press for open source to be considered as a viable option. And again, on a personal basis, as well as the Lib Dem IT spokesman, I've spoken on a number of platforms very strongly supportive of open source options and the development of this area.
You mentioned software patents. As I understand it, the Liberal Democrat policy is opposed to software patents. What I find confusing, though, is that according to the voting records, the Liberal Democrat MEPs seem to go against that policy and voted in favour of software patents. Can you explain that?
There weren't any votes in favour of software patenting. What there is, the debate we're having at the moment in the European Parliament, or we had in the European Parliament, is a debate about the interpretation of the wording of the draft directive on computer-implemented inventions. Now, that directive explicitly rules out patents on software of itself. In other words, it reinforces the position that the European Patent Convention established years ago, that software of itself shouldn't be patented. What it does do is try and create a common legal framework for all the patent offices across Europe to consider inventions, technical processes that also include an element of software. And examples that people use are things like computer-assisted braking systems and so on.
Right.
Now, the dispute that was taking place in the European Parliament was about the best form of wording that does that. So there was nobody was voting in favour of software patents. What they were doing was voting on the extent to which we should seek to restrict them, the extent to which we should narrow the definition of patentability. And there were different options that came forward. People were trying to add words to the directive to narrow as far as possible the definition of patentability. I personally was supportive of narrowing it just as far as we possibly could, and members of in the European Parliament, they're grouped into party groups across nations. Yeah. Members of the ELDR group, which is the Liberal group in the European Parliament, some of them followed one line which was supportive of amendments that went further in the narrowing process. UK Liberal Democrats supported a different group of amendments that didn't go so far. I have a personal view that I'd rather they went as far as possible in terms of the narrowing, but I think it's a mistake to think that anyone was voting for software patents. No one was. They were voting on different degrees of narrowing of that definition, and that's very important that we understand that, because we're not, I mean, the Software Patent Directive, or the Directive on Computer-Implemented Inventions, just say that it creates a framework of software patents just completely misreads it. What it's doing is saying what is patentable and what isn't, and I think we're having a very serious political debate about the narrowness of the definitions of patentability, but no one should get the impression that it creates software patents, because it absolutely doesn't.
It seems as though the European Parliament voted then broadly against the idea of strengthening software patents, but the Council of Ministers seem to have gone for a stronger implementation of software patents. Why should we even bother voting in the European elections if the Parliament's will is ignored like that?
I mean, there's no doubt in political terms it's the Council of Ministers that's most important, and I think some people sometimes forget that. They think a directive comes from Europe. It doesn't come from Europe. It comes from a group of national ministers getting together and deciding what they want. And in this case, the most important thing from a British perspective is the position that's taken by British ministers, like Lord Sainsbury, who's in charge of patent policy, and like the DTI generally, who oversee these things in the UK. They go along to Council of Ministers, and yes, that's in a sense the most significant decision-making forum. But the European Parliament does have a balancing effect. If the European Parliament, as they did, expresses an extreme amount of concern about this, then the directive will be amended, although there are generally processes that then are brought into place that mean that the directive is looked at again. So if you didn't have the European Parliament, what the ministers wanted first time round would just go through. So the European Parliament, in a sense, it can't override the ministers. Ultimately, it's the national governments getting together through the Council of Ministers to make the decision. But the European Parliament it's like the House of Lords, I guess, in the UK Parliament. It has this revision effect, and it makes them go back and think again. But again, we've got to be very clear that the dispute is between different versions of the directive. The directive of itself does not create software patents. We can't go back to that. What it does is it defines the limit of patentability, because people can apply today for patents for things that involve software.
Yeah.
And what we need to do is to define that definition on a European-wide basis. What the European Parliament have done is express a clear view that they want the definition tightened up. They've not said they don't want the directive. They said they want it to be very tight and very clear about what's patentable and what's not. And what the Council of Ministers have come back and said is, well, we think it's okay, you know, pretty much as it was. And so we're now going to go into a round of dispute about the wording and what is the most effective form of words. But both sides are trying to get a directive. It's just, you know, how that directive is worded that's important. And the directive will explicitly rule out pure software and business method patents. There's no doubt about that.
It will.
It will. I mean, that's the purpose of the directive. That's the whole point of it, is to reinforce this. So it's been misinterpreted. It rules out explicitly the sort of pure, you know, I come along with a computer program, I come along with Microsoft Word and say I want to patent it. Mm. You will not be able to patent Microsoft Word under this directive. It's reinforcing that position. The dispute is whether if you have a piece of computer software that causes, and it's horribly technical, but it's all about the technical effects, and that's what we're trying to, and it's a very important definition to get that right. But if you have a piece of computer software that makes a screen do a particular thing, is that or is that not a patentable invention? And that's what we're going into, is the definitions there, and how do we make sure the definition is clear, that for somebody like myself and the open source community, free software community, where we want to be very clear that the whole range of regular software that you'd run on a computer is not patentable, that we want to make sure this directive will exclude all of that. And the questions that are being asked are about the extent to which it does make that exclusion explicit and stop, you know, things like Amazon one-click stuff coming through. Or at the moment, there's a very important case that the Department for Education and Skills are actually taking, where they're trying to break a patent, I think quite properly, on the registration of pupil data over wireless systems. Now, that was permitted because it has a technical physical component, the wireless system, and a software component. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, by the time it was awarded, this wireless networking system may have been innovative, but very quickly afterwards it became standard off-the-shelf product. And it's those kind of tests that we need to apply to the directive. Will it include or exclude products like that? And that's where the debate is. The extent to which it excludes ordinary things that we might want to do on the computer, or the extent to which they can be sneaked in, if you like, because they have this technical component.
Do you think then, I'm sure you're familiar with Richard Stallman.
Yeah.
Do you think he's maybe got the wrong end of the stick slightly then?
No. I think he's absolutely right to argue. I'm actually quite at one with him. I think he makes a very powerful case for the general, the way in which the software world and the IT world, I think there's a general question about the extent to which patents should be obtainable in this area. And we have international conventions that say patents should be obtainable across the piece. I think he's raised some very important questions about patenting in this area altogether, because I don't see the same logic as, say, in the pharmaceuticals world. You can see a logic, in a sense, for patents. The whole point of patents is if somebody has discovered something that nobody else would have thought of, and typically is very expensive to discover, but even if it's not, but if it's something no one else would have thought of, then there's a public interest in getting that out so that other people can copy it. That's the whole principle of patenting. So what you're doing is you're saying you can have exclusive rights over this thing for a period of time and charge a license fee in return for making it available to everybody else, because no one else would have thought of it.
Yeah.
And Richard's argument, which I think is quite right, is that there are very few things in the software world in particular that no one else would think of. The problem in the software world is not having ideas, it's implementing, it's writing the code. And we all have 20 ideas every day when we're sitting at our desks about the software we could produce. The tough thing is to actually produce that code. If you do produce that code to deliver the concept you thought of, then you've got copyright protection. And if anybody else wants to do the same thing, they have to go through the effort of producing the hundreds of thousands of lines of code themselves, and then they're entitled to copyright protection if that's what they choose to do. But there isn't the same logic for having patent protection, because patent protection is only there to expose ideas that no one else would have thought of. Right. And I think that test does need to be applied. I think Rich has raised some very important questions about that, and that's really a test that I think we need to apply to this directive to be clear that it says it's probably not the directive, it's more the practice of patent offices generally, to be clear that patent offices, when they're presented with something in the IT sector, do take seriously this question of proving an inventive step and that something was non-obvious, which are general tests you have to apply in patent terms. So I think they need to be aware that a lot more is obvious in the IT sector than people might normally consider. The fact that it's clever doesn't mean it's not obvious, and it doesn't mean that there aren't 1,000 people around the world who've thought of it, particularly in the open source community, where the whole purpose of the free software community is to have lots of people thinking of ideas and sharing them with each other.
One of the things about the European Union Copyright Directive that has concerned a lot of people in the open source community is that it may hand large corporations far too much power over what we can do with copyrighted materials that we've paid for, such as CDs. Is that something that concerns you?
I think that's a valid area of concern. Again, what we want are assurances from the authorities that when they implement the directives are kind of permissive. They say these are the kind of things you can and should do to enforce copyright, but they don't sort of spell out in detail what member states, what the UK police and prosecuting authorities should necessarily permit in that context. And so I think it's very important that we do try and get a very clear idea from the authorities about what we're talking about. So, I mean, as long as there is a legal copyright regime, and I don't think people are challenging that, there are choices that we each can make about whether we want to try and restrict things through copyright or publish them openly. Mm. But as long as there is a legal copyright regime, then somebody who is sitting there and manufacturing thousands of CDs of a software program that they have illegally taken, you can understand there that police action, prosecution, so on, is appropriate. Quite severe action. In other cases, you know, somebody's got a few MP3 music files and things, they may be in breach of the law, but a very different form of action would be appropriate. And I think that's what we want to know. We want to know that proportionality will apply, which I think is the key test, that the actions taken will be proportional to the offence committed.
So what would be illegal under the UK's implementation of the EU CD? For example, if I made a few MP3s from a CD that I'd actually bought to listen to in the car, would that be illegal?
It's difficult. These things have got to be tested, because in a lot of things that people are doing today are illegal. The copyright directive is more about trying to define an enforcement regime than necessarily changing copyright law.
Right, okay.
But there are, again, valid disputes or arguments, political arguments to be had about things like fair use. Is it appropriate? And I think that's there's a sort of a whole history of UK case law that needs to be taken into account, mm-hmm. plus any directive that comes into force, to say, is that the example you give, is it okay to make copies for personal use, format shifting and time shifting and so on, on a personal basis, are those okay? And in a sense, we'd need case law to establish that. And that's where I think the implementation will have to reflect national law. It's got a set of principles saying you should enforce copyright, and these are the kind of ways you can enforce it. But that's, again, dependent on national law to look at the specifics of what's appropriate. The other side of the copyright debate, I think, is looking at something like the SCO case, where I have concerns, and I think we ought to sort of push up the political agenda. I have concerns about the way in which copyright law can be used to frustrate other people's developments. And in the SCO case, if you get a case like that, where that's a copyright infringement accusation, if that's allowed to drag on for 3 or 4 years, casting fear, uncertainty and doubt over a whole set of other essential ICT products, and I don't think the public interest is served by that. And so there are, as well as the sort of worries about people kicking your door in, enforcing copyright that way, or kicking in the virtual doors of your computer, and all of those I think are valid, I think we also need to consider that copyright law should be used in such a way where people get a speedy remedy where there's a clear breach, but it shouldn't be allowed to develop in such a way that it allows people to frustrate their competitors by, say, creating fear, uncertainty and doubt about products that are out there. And I hope that's where certainly the EU legal tradition, in particular the UK legal system, will not allow those kind of things to take place. And I think we very much have to watch what's happening in the US on the SCO case to see whether that is allowed to drag, or, as I hope will happen, they seek an early legal resolution so that other people can get on and do their own work.
The reason that we're doing this program is to help users of open source find, you know, find a way that they can use their vote to help open source software and issues of technological freedom. Now, probably your main competitor in this area is the Green Party. So can you give me a reason why people should vote for you, the Lib Dems, rather than the Green Party?
I mean, I think, to be fair, the Green Party, I think, have done a good job on this. They've picked up the issue and run with it. So fair play to them for that. But I think the difference is that as Liberal Democrats, we are fully engaged with the political process, as what, particularly in Westminster as well. I mean, we've got a strong European group, but we're able to work across the piece. And I think the critical decisions will be made, say, by UK ministers. So people need to think about voting for a party that can actually apply pressure across the board. The Greens have a presence in the European Parliament, and I'm sure we'll continue to use that. And say I wouldn't take away from what they've done with it, but I'm not sure that they've got the staying power, in a sense. I'm not sure they've got the presence across the piece, and I'm not convinced that they are taken sufficiently seriously within the decision-making process at the moment. That may change over time if they grow, but that's certainly not the case at the minute.
Richard Allen, IT spokesman for the Liberal Democrats, thanks very much.
Radio, giving something back.
Well, there we are, there we have it. Interesting points, I thought, made from the chap.
Yeah, he sounds like a pretty sound guy. It's quite unusual, I think, to find a politician, especially one quite high up in a party, who actually knows what they're talking about when it comes to open source.
Well, that's, I mean, the thing I found interesting, I mean, he knew his business. He knew what he was talking about. A lot of this has obviously got to do with the fact that he's got a vested interest in the issues that we're talking about today. The one thing that did make me chuckle was the whole thing about, you know, oh, you should vote for the Liberal Democrats because we're so much bigger than the Greens and we've got so much more clout than the Greens. I mean, yeah, but as Ack would say, it's a taller than a Ronnie Corbett competition, you know. It's ridiculous. I mean, they are bigger, but bigger in terms of sort of, I hate to say the word losers, but they're, you know, in terms of people who don't really have a proper impact on what's going to happen.
I think you're being slightly unfair to the Lib Dems. I mean, over the past few years, I think they've gained much more of a foothold in the UK. And I do think that they're listened to by people. And
yeah.
I think they have got a serious chance. Certainly, if you put it, you know, Green versus Liberal Democrat, then really the Greens are still unfortunately seen in the context of David Icke. I'm sure even international listeners will be familiar with David Icke. He was
viewers of Spitting Image will be.
Oh, what? Sorry,
Spitting Image. He was on Spitting Image.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, he was lampooned in that. But basically, this is a guy who now preaches a message of the world being run by lizards, as I mentioned in episode 8. But yeah, I think, you know, the Greens are becoming more of a serious party in people's estimations, but I think the Lib Dems certainly do, you know, okay, it might be a taller than Ronnie Corbett competition, but they are taller than Ronnie Corbett.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in the scheme of things, yeah, the Liberal Democrats, at the end of the day, they're the third major party.
Yeah, and in some areas, I mean, they're ranking above the Tories. So.
Yeah.
Certainly in Scotland, and you know.
This is it, but I mean the thing I always seem to hear about people, and you know, Richard Allen, is that his name again?
Yeah.
Richard should maybe has probably heard this from a few people, is that a lot of people say the Lib Dems have some great policies, but they're never going to get elected, so I'm not going to vote for them. And it's a bit of a kind of stabbing yourself in the back sort of perspective to take. And
it is catch 22, certainly.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, it is difficult to know when to vote. But the thing about the European elections is that they're proportional, so that if you vote for someone, then it does count. Whereas in the first-past-the-post system, obviously, it's the one who's got the most number of votes wins. Whereas, so if you vote for Lib Dem and Labour wins, then your vote essentially counts for nothing.
But the Lib Dems have got quite a... They have got their kind of... They've got vested interest in Europe, haven't they? They seem to take quite an interest in Europe. I mean, Paddy had quite an interest in Europe, didn't he?
Yeah, well, they are the most pro-Europe of the parties, certainly. And I think that yeah, in terms of open source, software patents, EU CD, all of that,
yeah,
if they've got somewhere someone like Richard Allen at the head of their IT policy, then I think it's pure luck, really. I think it's good for them, and it's good for us.
Yeah.
But I don't know how much it fits in with the general Lib Dem philosophy. I suppose it does, really, because they are generally slightly left wings and in favour of open ideas and things like that. So generally,
well, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, it's great to hear somebody who knows what they're talking about making, you know, actual comments on policy. So
And he's in the position to make policy as well, which is good.
Well, that's it. So we want more of that. And I suppose, you know, the thing about the Lib Dems, if they can garner some support from people such as us lot, it's going to increase their potential to get into government, maybe
exactly.
By, you know, 0.0.0.0.0, if there was lots of decimal places,
of
1%. So,
well, I don't know. I mean, okay, people listening directly to this don't have a huge influence, but I certainly think, you know, give them a chance. It sounds as though they've got some good policies and they've got a good understanding of it, more importantly.
Yeah.
So when they do make policy, they're not just going to be knee-jerk reactions or overly influenced by the big business lobby, which is important. So, you know, I say give them a chance.
And I suppose, I mean, one other thing which has just leaped into my brain is that with the Lib Dems, they are a more generic party, whereas with the Greens, obviously, they're very focused on environmental issues and things such as that.
Yeah,
so,
David Icke aside, obviously he was part of their past and isn't anything to do with their present.
All hail the Lizard King.
Yeah. forgetting about, you know, the slightly dodgy past, the Green Party still isn't seen in this country as a serious contender, for the simple fact that most people still want to use their cars, etc., etc., etc. And, okay, the environment's a very, very important issue, but I think, you know, while the Greens are at great pains to say that they're more than a single-issue party, unfortunately, I don't think that they're seen as that.
That's it, yeah. But I suppose it's that's the reason why the Munster Raven loonies never got into power.
Yeah, it's a shame.
Because, you know, the world needs more lunatics. Because we haven't got enough, have we? Right, let's move on.
Let's do it. As we mentioned earlier, we did try to contact all the main political parties. Now, we didn't actually get a response from the Conservative Party at all. But one thing that I would say about them, I mean, I'd automatically assume that they'd be the least open source friendly of the parties.
Yes.
And what I'd say, I don't want to go into great depth on the Tory Party because they haven't given us a time of day, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's not give them any airtime.
No,
race
sodom.
Time.
Basically, though, one of their MEPs is Michael Harbour, who is very pro software patents.
Yes.
So, based on that, I'd say don't bother voting Tory because they're not going to do any favours for the open source
movement. I saw Michael Harbour.
Ah, did
yes.
you?
Yes.
Tell me about him, because he's someone that I've read about on the internet and I've only read bad things about him.
Well, I went along to the Open Advantage launch in Birmingham, which was a couple of months back. And of all the politicians that they had to open the place, they had this Michael Harbour bloke.
So out of everyone that they could have chosen, such as Richard Allen, the MP, who's very open source friendly, Rob Maris, our local Labour MP, who's got Linux on his machine.
Right, and it was this bloke. Now, as far as I'm aware, it was this bloke. I remember the name Michael Harbour.
Yeah, I've read about it. I know he was the guy.
He actually did it, right. Because I know there was talk of maybe some other guy doing it. But if this is the guy that I think it was, which I'm pretty 95% sure it was.
It was, yeah.
He's very pro software patents. And I thought it was rather bizarre that he was opening the centre. But I think in some ways he's the way he's speaking is that he's very pro software patents. But he's also he also favours the views of open source software and the whole point of open source software.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I had no idea. If that's
the presentation that he was giving was kind of, he basically had a talk and sort of said, you know, well, you know, I think it's great to see centres like this exist and all the rest of it. The impression I got, because he kept reading from a piece of paper, was that he didn't actually really know what it was and he didn't know a lot about it. And I don't think he knew necessarily that his views and software patents directly contradict exactly what he thinks about, you know, open source and everything.
Right.
So, you know, but it was interesting watching him because it was kind of, he didn't know whether to kind of lambast the bloke or whether to just kind of you know, so nice one for coming down and sort of doing it. But, you know, it was an experience, to say the least. So,
right, well, yeah, based on the fact that they haven't bothered to speak to, I mean, we have made an effort. You know, we emailed various people, various different candidates. I think we emailed the press office, obviously, as well. That'd be your first port of call.
Yeah.
And basically they haven't bothered.
Are they saying that we're not press somehow or not important enough? You know, four blokes sitting around in my little studio talking about shite.
There you go.
Well, you know, we are press.
And we we're the UK's main source of open source radio, so
yeah,
you know,
there's not many more.
No, so okay,
steady, Matt. Matt's got a bit of a cough, as you might guess.
We'll cut that one out.
Yeah,
the Green Party,
great,
very, very helpful, very nice. I've actually emailed Chris Leonard, who's one of their MEP candidates. He's agreed to give us an interview. I've sent him some various questions, but unfortunately, they haven't come back in time for the recording.
Yes.
Having said that, though, I got some stuff through from the press office, and they said that their position on software patents is they're against them,
yep.
And open source, they're very pro-open source software, particularly for its use in government projects.
Right.
And in schools and things like that. So, great. Good on them.
Yeah, I mean, you get the impression with people like the Green Party that they've got to work much harder to get a foothold in people's views of politics. And in some ways, the fact that the Tories didn't actually respond to us demonstrates a level of complacency with the Tories.
You could say arrogance.
Yeah, you could. And as someone who will never, ever, ever, ever stoop to the point of voting for the Tories, this doesn't come as a surprise to me. So,
I mean, I generally do keep an open mind when I go to vote, but I have to say, based on the fact that, you know, they have a general attitude which seems to be run counter to open source software, I don't feel I could vote for them. Now, we were talking earlier about the idea of, you know, should you use your vote for one issue?
Yeah.
You know, is it irresponsible to vote just with open source software in mind? I think it probably is.
Right.
Because, you know, there's a lot more in the world than open source software. You know, we've got the war in Iraq.
Yes.
We've got general things like fuel tax, you know, or education, hospitals.
Yeah.
You know, so it would be pointless to vote in a party purely based on their stance on open source software. So I think the purpose of this program is probably just to say, in general, you know, if you're going to vote, say, for example, you were trying to decide between Liberal Democrats and Labour,
yeah,
then maybe the open source side would help swing you. So,
yeah, I mean, I think you've got to keep an open mind. You've got to look at the general picture. I mean, with me saying I'd never vote for the Tories, that's based on their past experience. That's based on their previous policies.
Yeah.
If they turned around tomorrow and said, you know, we're tidying the party up, we're going to be fairer, we're going to approach some different policies, you know, then I'd consider them.
Maybe consider them, but...
But given their past experience, not a jot, you know, and...
And particularly their... What it would appear their attitude towards open source software is from, I mean, they don't have any specific documents on their website or anything about it, but certainly their voting record in the European Parliament would indicate that they're very pro EUCD, pro software patents, all that sort
of thing. That's the
impression I get. So, you know,
I mean, to be fair to them, a chap called John Evans, who's a young candidate for the local elections. I contacted him, and he said he'd come down and do a recording with us. But the only reason why he said that is because he's my mate, you know. So he's kind of a friend, and he's eager to talk for the Conservative Party. And he's, you know, he's a bright young spark within the Conservative Party. But there was no official line from them, so we've got to just kind of just take it out as it is, really. So,
right.
Instead, we did have a very interesting interview today, didn't we, with Howard
Berry? Yeah, I mean,
Berry.
The Labour Party have been given us a good response, along with the Lib Dems and the Greens. One of the local election candidates in Wolverhampton is a guy called Howard Berry, who actually just happens to be a member of our Wolverhampton LUG.
Yep.
And he, along with the local MP, Rob Maris, is very pro-open source software.
Yeah.
So we got quite a good interview with him, actually.
I think what should be noted as well is that although Howard is part of the LUG, he's actually been very, very enthusiastic in terms of the issues involved with this. He's not just done it. I get the impression he wasn't just doing this from a friend's perspective. He was doing this from he's enthusiastic about himself, irrespective of whether he knew us or not.
Yeah.
So you know.
I mean, we don't see that much of Howard. So
yeah.
It wasn't a fact that he was just doing us a favour. I think listen for yourself to the interview. See what you make of it.
Right, we're here with Howard Berry, who's a Labour council candidate in the forthcoming local elections. Howard, if you get elected to the council, do you think there's any potential for open source within local government? Can you see it having benefits for local government?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I suppose the problem you have at the moment is, I think it's by next year, the local authorities throughout the UK have got to get their e-sites, their websites, their method of conducting council matters to the out on the web.
Right.
So there's a lot of progress being made at the moment. As to open source within that, I suppose it's easy for it to be pushed on one side, but on a local level, in smaller offices, council offices where you just need facilities for email access to the web and printing out and so forth, I can't see any reason why a Linux desktop could not do the job.
Right, and talking specifically about Wolverhampton for a moment, which will probably bore most of our listeners, but Wolverhampton, I suppose like many local councils, has, let's say, a website that's slightly lacking. Mm. Do you see the council being able to meet that target for next year to be able to get all its services online?
Well, I'm not an insider on
yet.
That. Not yet, no. I don't know. The answer is I don't
right,
know. I
okay.
do know that there are people working on it. But sadly, I went on the this morning on the Wolverhampton website and using my Linux top and got nothing. Absolutely a blank screen and unavailable. I wanted to check something out, but, not good.
Regarding the potential migration to Linux as an operating system within the council and within the services offered by the council, do you think that at the council level, open source could have enough drive due to the cost savings and the stability savings? I mean, do you think that it can be treated in a slightly different way as opposed to just being another potential solution for helping the council? I mean, do you think it could be treated differently because it's free and it's open source?
Well, the two factors. First of all, because it's free, or certainly low cost, yes, that could have a great influence. Because it's open source and therefore has a kind of patina of socialism, for want of a better word, or... egalitarianism, I think there's if people knew about it and knew about the philosophy of the open source movement, there would be quite an interest in that.
You mentioned socialism there. Obviously, you're from the country's main socialist party, the Labour
Party.
I'm
glad you think so.
Well, certainly when it was started. And do you think, though, that Labour... Well, okay, what is the general Labour policy, if there is one, regarding open source? Because I'd have thought it would be fairly favourable, seeing as though it is broadly in line with socialist thinking.
Yeah. Well, I think it's... I don't actually think there is a Labour Party document stating what their principles, what their feelings are towards open source. There are quite a number of people within the establishment, the Labour establishment, that are quite interested in it. I noticed, for example, that Ken Livingstone is doing some sort of work trying to encourage open source within London. There are other sort of examples here and there, but there's no actual coordinated movement within the party.
Do you feel that at the government level, open source has a potential to be seen as something that can put money in other areas? For example, let's say a particular hospital is based on proprietary software, such as, let's say, Microsoft systems.
Yeah.
and they move over to open source, and they're going to save X amount of money in licensing. Do you feel that that is a bargaining chip that can be used to say, well, we're saving money in this area, and we're going to put this money into practical areas such as sustaining services and actually sustaining hospitals in terms of medicine and staffing?
Yeah.
Do you think that that's an area where that Labour could capitalise on?
Well, it is, but there is a bit of a danger of overemphasising the freeness of free software.
Yeah.
Because free obviously means libre, rather than free right. beer, as the famous statement is.
Yeah.
So the training issue, what Microsoft have branded the total cost of ownership, and you know, those sort of things do tend to make people a little bit wary
right.
about going down the open software route. Well, not so much the open software, but the
free aspect.
Yeah,
I mean, because it seems that the one thing that both the Labour government and previous Tory governments have sought to achieve is to get out bureaucracy in the government.
Yeah.
Is to get rid of red tape. And we experienced that recently in the budget with Gordon Brown getting rid of X amount of civil servants to make yeah. way for more efficient systems. It strikes me that the bureaucracy of buying licenses and having to go through essentially the rigmarole of buying software that renting software if you have it by buying licenses, that could be quashed, and it could be a real source of revenue for moving over systems, and they would be supported by people such as IBM and Red Hat. I mean,
yeah.
What, as a practical kind of question, between the level of 1 and 10, how would you rate the viability of moving a total government over to open source, commercially supported systems?
Wow, that's quite a tough one. Going back into your question, I would say one of the problems is that you haven't got people with, in our case, socialist tendencies necessarily, that
right.
are actually in charge of the networks, the infrastructure. So what you've got is people with a knowledge base, and that's quite often based on Microsoft products, for example.
Right.
And they are, in other words, I'm talking about the inertia. Once you've got a situation where, and it's not just in government, everywhere, you've got people that are trained on Microsoft products. They feel at home. They quite almost they can cope with the bugs and the spam and all the rest of it, because at least they know where they stand. The danger, the fear of the unknown, is something that you can't put a sort of factor on, really. So in the 1 to 10, at the moment, I would say it was down there with the threes.
What about, rather than trying to hope to move every desktop and every server in the government to open source, what about the multi-million pound development projects, such as, you know, if the passport agency gets a new computer system?
Yeah.
Do you think there's any way that people such as us, or, you know, ordinary people, could lobby the government to try and persuade them to put these systems that are created at our taxpayers' expense into an open source license? Because, you know, if we're paying millions of pounds to get the system, then surely we should be able to benefit from it in many different ways.
Well, of course, yes, I agree. Lobbying is vital for...
Right.
Yeah. And as regards the sort of the principle, I would say, you know, the mantra of the environmentalists was that you think globally but act locally.
Right.
So if you look at what can be done... in our case, in Wolverhampton, and work upwards, there's a great depth of ignorance, really, about what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So you can't really go to people and say, well, this is what we want, and they say, I've never heard of it. What are you on about? Well, you're a load of geeks, you know.
Yeah.
Just, and the fact that it's free actually scares people off as well. It must be dodgy.
Yes, yes, of course. But, I mean, I suppose we've all come across that kind of... prejudice, I suppose you could say, but
yeah.
Talking about, you know, thinking globally, acting locally, what then can people who are listening to this in the UK, what can they do, do you think, in their local community to try and speak to people such as yourself?
Yeah.
Is it as simple as writing to their local council and saying, hey, look, these are the things that you could do with open source, these are the benefits they can offer you, or is it a bit more closed off than that, do you think?
I think it's, first of all, yes, writing in, because I think that politicians respond to the public. They don't generally dream up schemes of their own. They react. So yes, lobbying. As to what can be done locally, I heard of a great scheme. There's an article in the Guardian some while back about this guy in Edinburgh who was it was a lug, the Edinburgh lug, I think, and they were producing CDs of open soft software such as the Mozilla and OpenOffice. And they were distributing through the libraries.
Right, yes, I heard about that.
So they were starting from the grassroots, so people were aware. If you go into the Wolverhampton Library and you switch on go to a terminal there, it will be Microsoft, and you'll be using Internet Explorer. And people don't think there's any other alternative. So we've got to work up from the base.
So do you think the best way to promote... do you think the best way to promote open source from the perspective as a civilian trying to demonstrate its potential to the government, do you think that is to essentially to assimilate local resources and to promote it in libraries and to promote it in maybe in schools and to give it away in the street and, you know, to go to computer fairs and to go to all these organisations and put it in the faces of people? Do you think that the government will notice that at a local and a higher level?
Well, as you say, there's two elements. The local level, certainly, that would be great. I mean, the more movement, the more pressure there is, where people are actually brought to their attention that there is an alternative and the alternative is cheaper. So, you know, people saying, well, hang on, why are we spending so much on software licenses when all we do is to print out a few letters every day, get on the internet, receive email, what's the point?
Yeah.
People are going to change their ways. At the other end of the spectrum, further away, lobbying at EU level, at government level, has got to continue. It's sort of pincer movement, if you like, yeah.
There seems to be... there's been much discussion within certain parts of the Linux community that open source and free software and the ethics associated with those concepts are actually human rights. The right to be open and be free. Yeah. And the right that when I send off my self-assessment form, those systems that are processing my self-assessment form are proprietary systems.
Yeah.
And those systems, there's going to be elements of those systems that act in the black box fashion that maybe the people who are behind the software don't even know some of the underlying components. Obviously, open source free software is completely free. There's no kind of black box element to it. Everyone, you know, the IT people at the government can read all the source code at every level.
Yeah.
And there was a guy in Peru who claimed that this was a serious issue because you're feeding your civilians information through a black box at which the government doesn't understand what's part of what's going on.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's... That's quite a real threat for the government, or do you think it's kind of just a fantasy envisioned by geeks?
Well, one thing I do think is that the computer is a sort of object with which to think,
right?
And that the way a computer is constructed does affect the way people react, the way people work. So you can't dismiss it willy-nilly.
Yeah.
But I think that the black box principle that you're talking about is... I don't think most people are worried about that, to be honest. Certainly not in on a sort of political level.
But do you think that's maybe because it's never been an issue up until this point? I mean, the culture of software and the culture of IT has been you buy a piece of software from a company, essentially like buying some clothes off a rack.
Yeah.
Not the country Iraq, that is. But you know, you're buying this software, and the culture was that you didn't know how it worked. The culture was that you didn't get the source code. Do you think that with it seems that with open source, there seems to be a whole load of new issues that people are thinking about.
Mm.
And obviously the biggest challenge is making people interested in these issues.
Yeah.
Because 95% of people in the government probably don't really care about this.
That's right, yeah.
Until they're actually told about it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, do you think there's the potential for, you know, if people listening to this show lobby their politicians, mm-hmm. lobby their representatives, get in touch with their government, work hard in getting Linux and free software into the libraries,
yeah.
do you think there's theoretically enough weight that could be garnered to make this an issue, to say, you know, this is not on?
I would think so. I mean, as I said earlier, politicians respond to the public, and if there is a... and also, politicians are members of the public as well. Negative responses when I talk about Linux. Certainly within the Labour Party, the cooperative movement was at the roots of the Labour Party, and there's nothing more cooperative than the open source movement. And when people are aware of this, they're all for it. But then you hit the kind of brick wall with overcoming other people's prejudices or overcoming the inertia that we talked about earlier. I think keep going. It's not...
it's argued, though, by some people that maybe the Labour Party's moved away from its roots in quite a serious way. You know, that it still has a general socialist outlook, but that maybe some of those... You know, Tony Blair isn't maybe your typical... joint member of the Labour Party and Cooperative Party sort of person. You know, he's more interested in a slightly more right-wing way of doing things.
Yeah.
So do you think that that's set maybe a general culture that would make it maybe even an image issue, so that even if all the people listening to this programme decided to contact their local MP, contact the local councillor, do you think that the people at the top of government are maybe too... let's say in the pockets of big business to consider moving to something that's perhaps more in line with the roots of the Labour Party?
Well, there's a lot there, isn't there? First of all, let's take Tony Blair. He's not from a traditional socialist Labour route, obviously. But when you look at the record of what's actually been achieved by the Labour government over the last 7 years, it's quite strongly socialist in many respects. In other words, it's to do with redistribution and helping those that are less fortunate. As regards what goes on at the top, well, I know that they're doing trials for Linux in the office of the Deputy Prime Minister.
Oh, right.
So, you know, it's not completely closed off. If you can get through that you know, appreciate that, like I said, things are fairly slow. You know, I don't think there's a sort of a big swing from away from socialism within the Labour movement as a whole.
Yeah, okay.
You know, the people I work with, you know, we're still where we were.
Right, cool. So, okay, moving away from open source slightly.
Yeah.
One thing that's kind of been mentioned a lot in the open source and free software press over the past 1 or 2 years is things like the American, now I've got to get this right, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act,
yeah.
which in Europe has become kind of mirrored by the European Union Copyright Directive.
Yeah.
Now that's going to be put into UK law soon, I believe. Mm. What concerns most people is it seems that the EUCD is going to take away various different rights, such as when you buy a CD, you won't be allowed to sell it afterwards.
Yes.
Is there anything that we can do about that? Or, you know, will we be listened to if we go ahead and write to our MPs and about that? Or as it's come from Europe, is it too late? Have we just been dictated to?
I was just chatting to Jono earlier about that, and I'm not sure whether it's a fait accompli now. Even if the law has been passed, it's down to its interpretation. So we don't know. There are obviously going to be cases that come up. As to can we still fight it? Can we still make our position felt? Sure we can, yeah.
Right.
And the likes of you guys, I assume you're actually work in the IT industry, both of you. I know, yeah. Jono does. So you are the people that are at the sharp end of that. And it's got to be made clear that the creative process applies just as much to what we call geeks as it does to, scientists or people writing novels. So the more freedom, the less restriction, the better. But you've obviously got to keep the rights of people that are being ripped off in mind.
What is the Labour Party's official stance on this, and what is Howard Berry's official stance on this?
On copyright as a whole?
On software patenting.
As far as I know, I've not come across a Labour stance on it. And I think because Labour, in a sense, is a broad church, you've got some people that will probably be for it and take the view that it's protecting people's rights, and those people that I would say I was one, where it was weakening the opportunity for creativeness.
Right, so I mean, obviously the EU CD and software patents are separate issues, but they kind of go hand in hand. Yeah. So there's an MEP for Cheshire and the North West thing called Arlene McCarthy, who's a Labour MEP.
Yeah.
She's been incredibly outspoken in favour of software patents, in favour of the, as the European Parliament jargon goes, the patenting of computer-based inventions, I think it is, something like that. She seems to, as an individual, she seems to be very, very passionate that software patents are the right way to go.
Yeah.
I don't understand how that fits in with the socialist outlook, because to me, you know, I would be the first person to support someone's right to earn a living from their inventions and their ideas, and also, you know, to get a revenue from things that they've created. That to me, that's just justice, you know, that's fine. But software patents, it's different. It's you know, it's about Richard Stallman puts it that, you know, there's a whole lot of different ways of achieving the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's that way of finding those different ways of achieving that thing that is where the creativity comes in.
Yeah.
So you can't patent that one thing, because it's just unfair, basically.
Yeah.
And I'd say that's a fairly socialist stance. I mean, why do you think that one of the MEPs, the Labour MEPs, is so in favour of it?
I don't know, but all I can guess is that you just take a balance, don't you? And you could say it was a socialist thing to be protective towards the needs, the rights of the individual. And if the individuals, yes, sort of Microsoft,
it's not individual, though. It's amazingly big business. I mean, essentially, what's going to happen if the full software patenting directive is passed through with all the amendments that someone like Arlene McCarthy would look for, then what you're going to have is say Jono and I started a little business, we'd have to wade through so much red tape to even think about writing a bit of software that just wouldn't make it worthwhile.
Yeah.
And the second that we encroach on someone's patent, then we as the small, you know, two people trying to earn an honest living, we get stamped on by someone like Microsoft, IBM, or whoever.
Yes.
I just don't understand. See, that's what I was talking about earlier, about it seems in some quarters the Labour Party has moved away from the socialist roots that it had.
Yeah.
I know we've got to live in the real world as it is now, and I know that the socialism of Keir Hardie and 100 years ago maybe may not apply to now. But I just don't... I suppose the whole point in this programme, sorry to ramble on, but the whole point in this programme is to try and find out how open source fans can vote in these forthcoming elections. And when you see someone like Arlene McCarthy really, really supportive of big business like Microsoft at the expense of the individual, it doesn't add up. I just don't get it.
Well, I mean, you're almost putting me in a position to try and defend her. And
not so much. I want you to say why we should vote for the Labour Party in spite of seemingly un-Labour Party like actions in the area of software patenting.
Yeah.
You know, so if you say to me, well, okay, we're not all like that. She's, you know, the basis is still there to support things like this, then
Yeah,
that's a valid answer as well. You know, rather than just defending her.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really a tough question for me to answer, because it doesn't feature on the radar screens of many politicians. This, therefore, there's no particular policy, no particular interest, as I'm aware of. But don't forget, I'm right down at the bottom of the amongst the roots of the grassroots, so. I can't honestly answer that question. Why should they? Will it benefit the open source movement to vote Labour?
Essentially, yeah. That's my question. That's been my question for everyone. Should an open source person vote Lib Dem? Should they vote Green? Should they vote Labour in this case?
Yeah. And I can't honestly put my hand on my heart and say, if you vote for me, because that's what I'm plugging for at the moment, it will help, because I don't know whether I'm a member of the LUG. Do you don't have a membership card?
Yeah,
you're
a member.
I describe myself as a country member. I read the bulletins and. But anyway, I would be on a local level, certainly very, very keen. And even if I don't get in, I'll certainly be keen to support Linux open source movement generally in whatever way I can. And. I think it's down basically to individuals throughout the movement to be to say, yeah, I think that's great, or no, I think you're barking up the wrong tree.
This this rather conveniently leads me on to my next question. Obviously, Howard, you're someone who's very familiar with the issues of Linux and open source. You're someone who's taken an interest in it yourself, and you're a person who's got an interest in politics. Mm. So you're in a very, very unique position. In the sense of you're part of a handful of politicians who actually care about the issues to do with this, in many ways you're the Luke Skywalker of the open source movement. in the sense of, you can use that as well. It's not copyrighted. You have an opportunity, being in the position that you're in, to really make a practical difference.
Mm.
To people such as the listeners of this show, because obviously we can make as much effort as we can, but we're regular civilian people who probably don't necessarily have the same kind of connections that yourself would have, and the same kind of clout that you might have in the local level. And obviously you play a part in the jigsaw. What efforts do you plan on making to actually really make a difference in these areas that we're discussing?
Well, first of all, I think to say I will have clout. Well, I'd like to think so, but it's fairly easy to overestimate the power of an individual even within a political party. So, having said that, at a local level, what I'd like to do is to say, let's have a look at what goes on in libraries and in schools. Restrictive practices, for instance, that a lot of schools have systems where they pay a license fee to Microsoft for their computers, but they also, if you had a Linux computer, the you'd be paying Microsoft for that as well, because the software agreement covers all the computers in a school. That sounds a bit dodgy to me, and I think we need to ask questions about that. To give people alternatives. Why on earth do we all need to use Microsoft Office all the time?
Right.
Why can't we use something cheap and, well, cheap and cheerful, free. Free and just as effective.
But do you, as somebody who's obviously vying for votes, are you happy yourself becoming an outspoken opposer of certain, like, for example, software patents or some of the issues to do with copyright that that are threatening free software? I mean, are you quite happy to be quite an outspoken member of this kind of belief?
Yeah, I am. Full stop.
Right.
But there is a proviso that I would make sure that what I was saying was the truth.
Yeah.
I wouldn't. I don't want to espouse a cause just because it's it fits in with my sort of philosophy deep down. It's got to be straight and true.
That's the perfect answer, really. I mean, I suppose certainly everyone involved in Lug Radio is a pragmatist. You know, we're not extremists who have one narrow point of view and will only see that. I mean, yeah, you have to support something because it's true, and you have to speak for it because it's true. So that's great. I mean, I suppose moving away slightly from everything we've been talking about before, it would be foolish, I think, for someone to vote purely based on open source software. Mm. I think that would be irresponsible. I think we pretty much all agree with that.
Yeah.
So, just briefly, why should someone vote Labour in these forthcoming elections for everything other than open source and software patents and all that? You know, what? Just briefly, what will Labour offer the voter?
More of the same. And don't get upset, I don't mean invading another country.
Right, okay.
I mean supporting young families, people that are finding it difficult to get by at that difficult period of time. Support for people in training, widening that. Support in the elderly. If you look at the Labour record, I have got a bag full of statistics. There is a little red book somewhere which is full of our achievements, and it's not built upon just statistical analysis. It's built on real achievements that you can see around you.
Right. Going back to the specifics of open source software patents and the European Copyright Directive, the Liberal Democrats and the Green Party have very clear policies that are in favour of the things that we would broadly support as a community.
Mm-hmm.
Why should we vote Labour rather than them? And that could be, I mean, I don't mind if your reasons are, you know, general because affecting other issues, you know, just why should we use our vote for Labour rather than the Lib Dems or the Greens?
Oh, but you're talking about a single issue there, aren't you?
In this particular case, yeah.
But you can't vote, I don't believe you can vote on a single issue of, when you're... We're talking about people that are worried about libraries, worried about the roof of their council house. So open source in that context is pretty low down the priority list. So I don't want to push it as something that should be voted for. All parties, I would think, have got something to say, because it's a fairly, in a sense, anodyne subject. It's not the sort of thing that people hop up and down about and get hot under the collar, although I've read some of the stuff on the Lug, maybe I'm wrong there, but you put in a general context, it's like agreeing with motherhood and apple pie. You know, we're all in favour of openness. When I say we all, most people seem to be in favour of openness and not paying too much and against oligarchies ripping us off.
Do you think that issues such as this, obviously this is a minor issue, the issues that we're talking about, in the sense of, you know, it obviously doesn't compare in the level of interest to something such as tuition fees.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is the kind of critical mass that an issue such as this needs to get to before it's really considered by a party? I mean, there's a lot of these smaller issues that, from a cynical standpoint...
Get swept away.
They just get swept under the carpet. Yeah. No one really cares about them, other than the obsessives and interested parties within the government. What critical mass does something such as this need to become an issue, to become something that you're going to see and you're going to read about in the papers, other than reading about it in Computer Weekly or Linux format?
When you say this issue, you're talking about open source?
Regarding the umbrella of issues that we're talking about, regarding getting free software open source into... charities, schools, government, and of course issues regarding copyright and software patents.
Well, I suppose in a way the critical mass has already been reached. In if you've got big boys like IBM moving in and saying what they've got to say, which is very positive towards the not just Linux but the philosophy of creating new software products.
Yeah,
that cuts quite a lot of ice, I would have thought, with any government. As regards on a public general level, as we were talking about earlier, if people are aware of it, use it, and say, well, this is okay. What's the big fuss about? I can still use internet. I can still send emails. I can write my little notes to whatever. I can even make newsletters up.
Yeah.
Then they're quite happy. I mean, the ordinary person doesn't give a cuss of what the operating system is.
Yeah.
It's just ease of use.
Yeah.
And if I know Linux has got a long way to go on that score still, but once that's correct, and I think it's on its way, then that's.
But I suppose in many ways the ease of use factor, that's an issue for consumers.
Yeah.
But for government institutions, to a point, they could install anything on their systems.
Yes.
So long as the staff are trained in it, it wouldn't really matter because it's managed and it's defined.
Yeah.
So I suppose it's from my personal opinion, it's just a case of Linux and open source getting to a point where people who have got enough clout in the government can sort of say, "Hang on a second, we're paying X amount of cash for these systems, and we can get these alternative systems a lot cheaper that work a lot more efficiently." Even with the training considered.
Yes.
And, of course, we're not locked into vendor file formats and all the rest of it.
Yep.
So, I suppose there's a number of issues, and it's great to see Howard sort of pushing the direction, really.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, we do agree that open source is a minority issue, but I think that generally there are some important issues surrounding it that will have a definite effect on people's lives.
Yes.
So it's good that there is someone such as yourself who is okay. You say that you're at the very roots of the grassroots, but that's brilliant. It's great that there is someone out there who is standing in a major election, and you have an understanding of and a support for open source.
Yeah.
So, and it's great also that the IT spokesman for the Lib Dems is a former open source developer, and I think really I know people keep saying it, and I don't think this is the year of open source. People keep saying it is, but I think that's nonsense, really. But anyway. I think certainly we're seeing a really good development, and thanks.
No, can I just interrupt you and say that the local MP, Rob Maris, I've never chatted to him much about open source. It's not the sort of thing that crops up in ordinary conversations, but when I knew I was going to talk to you fellas about this, I had a word with him, and he has Linux on his desktop as well. So it's a dual boot, like a lot of people. So, there's a sort of groundswell, maybe. There's people that are disposed to it in a philosophical way, and it's little practicalities that have got to be overcome.
Yeah, Rob seems really cool on many of the issues. I mean, I've spoken to him a couple of times about, copyright, patents, all that sort of thing, and he seems to be broadly in favour of the sort of the way that we think. So I think it's really great that things are moving this way, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as we sort of wrap up the interview, I think the key thing to be learnt for Lug Radio listeners here is there's a lot of people like Howard out there who have an interest in the subject and who want to talk to people about the subject and want to be talked to by people about the subject. Mm. And, we're a community, and we're a community driven by everyone playing their part. It's the equivalent of walking the old lady across the road. You've got to do your bit. And that ain't going to happen unless people pull their finger out and actually make a difference with it and actually go to their libraries and give them CDs with Knoppix on there and actually make an effort in this area. And I think, in many ways this interview is a demonstration from what you've been saying, Howard, that it's all about people making their effort as well as the representatives making their effort.
Yeah, I've got something to say on that, because I think there is a danger for lugs across the world, really, to be considered to be exclusive rather than inclusive.
Yeah.
And it's got to come over maybe in the postings or maybe on the websites and so forth that we are open.
Yeah.
And ready to accept other people and to get ourselves out into the community.
Yeah. I think there's definitely an element of introspection within lugs because lugs tend to, from some of my experiences trying to organise certain advocacy campaigns, lugs have been fine to talk about Linux within their little community. But in terms of exposing Linux and free software to their local community and non-LUG members, there seems to be less of a take-up.
Yeah.
And I suppose part of that is encouraging new people to come along and also encouraging people to go along and you know, take CDs to places in their local community, to talk to schools, to talk to charities, you know. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, roll on the day. I mean, I'd love that.
Yeah. So, brilliant. Well, I think, have you got anything to add, Matt?
No, I think that covers everything. Thanks. Cheers, Howard. It's really appreciated.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Howard.
Well, I thought that was pretty interesting, don't you think?
Yeah, I think the most important thing that he said was that he, as an individual councillor, if he gets elected, can't do a great deal.
That's right, yeah.
But we as a community, what he was saying was, you know, we as a community can write to our councillor, write to our MP, regardless of whatever party they're from, and we can have an influence that way. You know, if we all get together, you know... It's the typical apathy thing, isn't it? People are all, oh yeah, yeah, I'll support Linux, yeah, and open source software, you know, on a mailing list, and they're all, yeah, yeah, you know, they're all really, really super supportive. But when it actually comes to doing something, people are crap, basically. So what we need to do, come on, listeners, let's get together, let's write to our MPs and our councillors and say, why is our tax money being wasted on Microsoft licenses when it could go to curing people of cancer? Why is it that, as Howard said, in a school, every machine, regardless of whether it's got Microsoft on it or not, has to pay a license to Microsoft? I thought that thing had been made legal.
I think this is the problem, though, is that probably the biggest enemy of our community is apathy. And there's a lot of armchair critics.
Oh, gotcha.
And if people want, you know, if people are going around saying, oh, you shouldn't use Windows, it's crap, and you should use Linux, and people are saying, well, you know, Linux doesn't do this for me yet, or Linux doesn't do that for me yet, then we need to change Linux. But there's enough people changing Linux at the moment. What we don't have enough people doing is getting the word out about Linux. We need to get people to know about it, and we need... You know, I mean, although, like, for example, we're doing the Info Point tomorrow in Wolverhampton, and that's going to be really successful, I think, like all the other Info Points have been.
Yeah, which, just to briefly explain, is a thing where various different Linux users groups go to their local computer fair and promote Linux to people. You know,
that's right.
And let's not forget why this is important. I mean, quite apart from the fact that our tax money has been wasted on proprietary software, it's dangerous for... Whether you're a capitalist, a socialist, or whatever you are, it is dangerous for one company to have such a grip of the software market. You know, it's not good for us, it's not good for governments, and it's not good for business.
Yeah.
So it's important that an alternative is available, a serious alternative.
I think the only way that the government will listen to people who are, I think within any government, be it Labour, Conservative, Green, or Liberal Democrat, whatever, there's an element of, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And that occurs in everything. It occurs in business, government, schools, between your mates, whatever. And the problem is that things aren't going to change unless people in the know say that, you know, you should be moving over to this open source software, or there's enough critical mass to make people look into it.
Yeah,
and that's the way we can have a strength in numbers and have people such as Howard, who, yeah, I mean, I loved his quote about, you know, I'm the roots of the grassroots.
Yeah.
We need people like Howard, and there's various other people who are involved with getting open source into government, people such as Carolyn Halcrow and Konzai Maris and various other people who are really making some efforts into this. And we need more of these people, but we also need the critical mass. And everyone has the opportunity to play a part. So we need to sort of club together, you know.
Yeah, and we need to write to our MPs and say, why is it that when we spend £2 million on a new computer system for the MOD... or for whoever, that it isn't open source? Now, they might say, oh, security issues, blah, blah, blah. But it's fairly well documented that open source software is more secure than closed source software.
It's getting to a point now where, I mean, a few years ago, you could recommend open source to people, and there were still substantial chunks missing. So there was an element of kind of, people used to err on the line of, well, we don't know. Because there was bits missing that wouldn't be suitable. It's getting to a point now where there isn't really much of an option for you not to move over to it, other than satisfying certain contractual obligations with big corporate companies or retraining people. Retraining people is the big one.
Yeah, I think retraining in a lot of cases is more a case of Microsoft-based network technicians who are scared of actually having to use a system that doesn't do everything for them. And the reason why it's good that it doesn't do everything for them is that they actually have to think about closing off these security holes. Here's an example. I was speaking to a guy the other day who had just set up IIS 6 on Windows 2003 Web Edition.
Right.
And he said, you know what I hate about this new IIS 6? Everything's closed off. I have to open everything rather than it being open for me. So all the different ports were closed off. So he wanted to set up PHP on it. He had to go through and make it open up the ability to put PHP on it.
Right.
Because it now IIS 6 is a little bit more secure. And it's that kind of attitude that's a problem.
Yeah.
You know, basically, network technicians will, if they're a bit crap, speak against open source software because Linux is something that they actually have to think about. Whereas IIS 6 is taking the right step in terms of security, but still there's a nice GUI interface which automates everything for them. The problem being that there's little bits that you don't always see.
But
whereas if
this is the appliance generation, you know, and
it is.
It's a case of, you know, people expect you to be able to plug a red box into the wall and it's just going to tick over and work. And in some cases, that's fine. That's why we buy appliances. But in the concept of government services, you need people who know what they're doing. Now, they might be experienced in Microsoft technologies, fair enough, you know, and they might be experienced in Unix technologies or Mac technologies or sausage technologies. Who cares, you know? The fact is that the people who manage the technologies are secondary to the technology itself. The most important thing is getting the functionality working. Mm. If that means making something more efficient, faster, lower cost, that's the priority. If you choose a different software system and it's going to mean people retraining, so be it. That's the way it works.
Yeah, because there's more at stake here than just cost. It's about, you know, being in control of our information.
Yeah.
Being able to retain ownership and knowledge of what happens to our data.
Yeah.
And when we've got a government that's hell-bent on implementing biometric ID cards with one central database, let's bloody hope it's not a Microsoft database that's running it.
There's elements. I mean, we could theoretically sit here all day talking about the pros and cons of moving over to an open source system, and much of this has been discussed before. The key thing that, like we've said before, like you were saying earlier on, Matt, the one thing that I'm hoping that this show will do is it will first of all educate people as in to the issues involved, and secondly, it will encourage people to go out and do something about it, because we're not going to get there if we all don't club together. Some of us are doing a lot, some of us are doing a little, and we all work and we've all got family commitments and other things that we do. But, you know, like we've said before, you know, if it means just talking, even just telling your neighbour about Linux, that's helping the community out.
Yeah. And going back to the original point in this programme, I think that, well, this is probably how I'm going to vote. For the European elections, I think I'm going to vote Green. The reason being that I think that in a proportional election over quite a wide area, they have enough mass to actually get an MEP into Parliament.
Right.
They've already got a couple. I think they can maybe get two or three this time, you know.
Maybe if we tell a couple of our friends.
Yeah,
exactly. Push it over the edge.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole point of this programme, you know. And they have voted in such a way that they are completely against software patents and they're completely in favour of open source software. Now, Richard Allen of the Liberal Democrats, he was very good, but he's only
very
one
good
man.
Yeah.
And the MEPs who are the Liberal Democrat MEPs haven't been quite so anti software patents as he is, despite the Liberal Democrat policy. So I don't feel I can vote for Liberal Democrats.
Yeah.
They might be a more credible party. But I think in the European elections, I don't think that's such an issue. I think that the Greens have enough critical mass. In the local elections, I happen to be in Howard Berry's ward, so I'm going to vote for him because I'm quite sure that he's a man on our side and he'll do his best, you know.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for Howard, then I'd probably vote Liberal Democrat in the local elections.
Right.
Because I think they stand more of a chance of getting in than the Greens. So, you know, obviously it's up to you how you vote, and again, I'd stress, don't try not to vote, you know, just with one issue in mind. Try and take it all in mind. But, you know, open source is quite an issue, quite, and these issues of technology freedom are important, so bear them in mind when voting.
That's it. I mean, if if you use Linux, open source, BSD, whatever, if you use it and you enjoy using it, and maybe you work in it or you want to work in it, these issues are of paramount importance. You know, the one thing we're not saying is not to be, you know, you don't have to become a politician. You don't have to become an activist. We're not activists. We're not politicians. We're just a couple of guys with opinions. And Sparks and Ack, when we record Lug Radio 9, you know, we'll have a chat with them. Unfortunately, they couldn't make it down today because they're busy. You know, it's a case of we're just people with opinions. And all of you folks out there are people with opinions as well. So, like, share your opinions with people. And maybe, you know, maybe we can make the threat against free software a little more limited than it could be if some of this legislation goes in.
Yeah, and get yourselves on forums.lugradio.org to let's discuss this further. Let's see what ways we can use our vote and letters to MPs and all that sort of thing. Let's see how we can use our political influence collectively to make the environment better for open source software, for free software, for technological freedom. And information freedom. And also email us at show@lugradio.org to tell us, you know, what you think of the whole situation.
That's it. I mean, it's first of all, I think we should we'd like to thank obviously Richard Allen and Howard Berry for their time.
Yep, and the guy Kermit from the Chris Green Party, Chris Leonard, the MEP candidate, who unfortunately we didn't get his answers to our questions in time for the recording, but you know, thanks to everyone who has responded and taken part in this programme.
And we also welcome the Conservative Party to let us know what their views are on things, and we'll reload those things onto our listeners.
Yep. So thanks for listening. Let's get moving. Let's use our vote. Let's use our political influence for open source software.
All right. Take care, folks. We'll see you soon.
Bye.